Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, the government shutdown, week four. The Trump administration forces thousands of furloughed workers to return to their jobs without pay. Nancy Pelosi urges the president to postpone the State of the Union address, and the White House economic advisor says the shutdown's impact on the economy will be worse than predicted. Seemed like a good week to invite Norm Ornstein back into the studio. He's been writing about the U.S. government's descent into partisan dysfunction for years. Most recently in the book, One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Norm Ornstein, government shutdown week four. Any movement toward ending it?
No, there hasn't been any movement. Now, of course, we've set the record. We have the longest shutdown ever. The biggest problem that we have is that the president has put himself into a box canyon. And where I think we're going to have this impasse even more difficult to resolve is because his standard now is going to be whether this is accepted by Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, and Mark Levin, and Stephen Miller, and almost anything that he does that is not a huge sum of money for a wall will be rejected by them. And that's how we got into this mess in the first place.
Of course, and the consequences keep piling up.
So I could see a couple of ways out of this. One way, I think, is when the economy, instead of having a slow hemorrhage, and it is now, we're seeing a serious impact of this on the economy in a variety of ways, is when we get a more direct jolt. And here's the jolt that I can see coming, and it is that airline pilots refuse to fly. And it's not the TSA issue. Of course, you can have long lines and disruption there. It's the air traffic controllers. It's hard to imagine a more high-stress job than being an air traffic controller. Add on the stress that you don't know whether you're going to be able to make your mortgage payment or have food to put on the table. And then imagine that we have some air traffic controllers who do a double shift and then go out and spend 8 hours driving an Uber so that they can bring in a little cash. If I were a pilot, I would be very hesitant to fly under those circumstances. So if we get a stoppage in air traffic, then I think Congress will have to step up. And here we have another actor who becomes the key player, and that's Mitch McConnell. Donald Trump precipitated this shutdown. We had a deal. You had a unanimous Senate, which is extremely rare under any circumstances, saying fund most of these departments and for the remainder of the fiscal year, which ends September 30, and Homeland Security, where the wall is the issue, for a month, and we'll try and work it out. And Trump had agreed to that, which is why it passed unanimously. And then Ann Coulter spoke up, and that was the end of that. But since we had this breach, it's Mitch McConnell who refused to take up the same bill again that would pass with a veto-proof majority. Once you get Republican funders and major supporters saying this has to end now, they will pass this and over a presidential veto. Now, that's not going to resolve everything. We're still going to have this question of the wall. And here's the other way in which I can see this resolved. Members of Congress, including Republicans especially, are trying to float a deal that would work. Remember, going back, that Democrats had offered $25 billion for the wall in return for the Dreamers getting DACA passed. Now, that was even just 3 years for DACA, and Trump rejected it. Now, if you actually offered the $5 billion that he's asked for, or $3.5 billion in return for DACA, It's a big victory for Democrats, but many wouldn't accept it. Now, if you put on the table, because I think Trump is in such a weak position, something that includes permanent DACA fix, support and protection for asylum seekers, and a ban on child separation as a policy, and maybe some additional adjustments in immigration, we might get a deal in return for some money for a wall. There are going to be people on both sides who would be unhappy with that, but we'd be resolving a lot of issues that otherwise are not going to get resolved, and doing a lot for a whole lot of people in the country.
Norm, Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to President Trump urging him to think about postponing State of the Union address.
I am so both bemused and intrigued by this dynamic. Donald Trump has never faced an adversary like Nancy Pelosi. Nancy is as tough and wily a leader as I've seen in the political world. She owes him nothing. He has no leverage over her. And I thought this move was utterly brilliant. It was not only suggesting that we postpone the State of the Union because the shutdown damages security, but also saying you can always do a written one.
Exactly.
And I think he is befuddled by this. So we had the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, say, well, if she won't invite him to the Capitol, and of course the House chamber is her house, she can make those decisions about whether a president comes or doesn't come. McConnell said, well, we'll invite him. Of course, you put Trump in the Senate chamber, which is tiny in comparison to the House chamber, has almost no room in the galleries. And it is a venue that would reduce Trump, shrink him to a level that he would find anathema. Or if you put it in the auditorium in the Capitol Visitor's Center, it would actually in some ways be even more demeaning. So I suggested maybe they should go to the Tune-In, the dive bar on Capitol Hill, and do it there. But this puts Trump, I think, in a position that he can't quite understand. And when he had the leaders over to the White House, of course, after his enormous gaffe of saying, I'll do the shutdown and I'll own it and I won't blame you, even though he's tried to blame them, he thought, I'll just cut a deal with them, and had no clue that he was operating with a very different person who actually knows how to make a deal and how to drive the hardest bargain. And I think for the next 2 years, if Donald Trump is there for the next 2 years, that he is going to have nightmares about Nancy Pelosi.
You know, at one point, Donald Trump said the shutdown could last for months or even years. There are a number of people who are suggesting that the ultimate motive here was to reduce the federal government. And we've seen so many federal employees who cannot withstand no pay leaving. Is that his ultimate goal?
I think attributing goals to Donald Trump or strategy to Donald Trump is giving him way too much credit. He's operating on impulse. Having said that, we have a Congress, Republicans in Congress, where large numbers of them are, I think the only word I could use is nihilists, but people who do not believe in government and who are oblivious to the carnage that can come with these policies, who see this as a positive thing. And it goes beyond that. If you look at the way that the Trump administration has governed for the last 2 years, now we have a revelation that after the devastating hurricane in Puerto Rico, Trump said, I don't want a dollar to go to Puerto Rico. They didn't vote for me. Send it to Texas and Florida. There is a meanness to this, but also a belief that if government disappeared, everybody would be better off. Now, it's not just that many federal employees will quit because they'll have to find jobs.
That
how are we going to recruit people? How are we going to recruit people to be in the federal government? You know, one of the things that's sort of a mantra for me when I go out and talk about governance is we have this enormous problem with cyber terrorism. It's the Russians influencing the election. It's the Chinese who are stealing corporate secrets and doing what they can to disrupt other things. The electrical grid could go. The banking system could be hacked. It was Chinese government people, now appears, who got the 500 million accounts from Marriott and Starwood. We know that terrorists are doing this. So imagine it's recruiting season at Stanford. And all these bright electrical engineers and computer scientists are coming out, and there are the booths for Snapchat and Intel and Google, and they're offering staggering packages, money, perks, free food, all of that. And then they go to NSA and CIA and DIA, the government agencies that deal with cyber terror, and what they're told is, here's what we can give you. 3-year pay freeze, probably turn into 5 years. We have no idea what kinds of shutdowns will take place, so you won't get paid during that time. We can't tell you right now if you'll have a job. You'll have to wait 6 months, and then we go through the security clearance process, and then pay your way to Washington. It's tough enough if we don't have this kind of attack on the substance of government. The only good that comes out of this is people who think government has no impact on their lives are going to discover that these agencies affect their daily lives. We're not getting food safety checks done. We've got all of these problems with security at the airports, the plane inspections from the FAA, on and on. These are things that government does for the good of the American people,
so,
and they're being undermined.
Do you believe that Donald Trump is even beginning to see maybe he made the wrong decision?
From what we're hearing, and of course there are leaks everywhere from inside the White House, he's furious with all the people around him because he knows he's losing this battle. He's losing some of the support from his base, and instead of shoring up the base, it may be having the opposite effect. But this is not in terms of, oh my goodness, look at the damage I'm causing in the country. It's, I'm not winning. And maybe that will be enough. What we're also seeing is, you know, the 800,000 people who are out of work or who are not getting paid, 420,000 of them are working and not getting paid. The damage there is enormous. We know that the ineptitude at the Department of Housing and Urban Development that failed to sign contracts for housing subsidies before they went out, that now we're seeing people being evicted. We know as well that there are many businesses that depend on the federal government. Small business loans aren't being secured, but also businesses around national parks, restaurants that have federal employees coming in are suffering mightily. The airlines themselves are saying that all of this is costing them a fortune. All of that damage, some of it is going to be people who are supporters of Trump, but you know, we're not going to recover from this for a while. And we know, among other things, that in some of the national parks where they've kept them open but without any of the rangers or supervision, people are going in and they're cutting down trees. They're going into pristine areas and ruining them. It's going to be years, if not decades, before some of that damage is undone. It's a tragedy.
Surely Mitch McConnell is seeing all this. Why do you think he is not acting?
What we have is a Republican Party that is now the Trump Party. And leaders and most of the followers are frightened of that base of people who, if you go against Trump, will go after you. And we have to keep in mind at this point as well that Mitch McConnell is up in 2020, and the fear of a primary may be a part of this. But I think it goes beyond that in an even more troubling way. We had a vote in the Senate the other day on whether they would insist that sanctions be imposed against the companies owned by the Russian oligarch Deripaska, who is close to Putin and was very likely involved with a whole series of money laundering schemes and probably with all the efforts to undermine our election process and our democracy. the Congress imposed sanctions, and the Treasury Department under Steve Mnuchin wanted to erase them. So the Senate voted, and they needed 60 votes, and they only got 57. Mitch McConnell voted not to have sanctions. Susan Collins voted not to have sanctions. Mitt Romney, who we remember in a debate when he ran for president in 2012, insisted that Russia was our greatest geopolitical foe, voted not to have sanctions. If we're not going to take even the smallest steps that signal to Russia that we're serious about this, now, of course, we have Rudy Giuliani, his lawyer, saying, well, I never said there wasn't collusion. I just said the president wasn't involved.
I was going to ask you about that.
It's mind-boggling, Diane.
What is he doing?
So it's hard to figure whether Rudy Giuliani is acting as a lawyer or a public relations person. Either way, this is malpractice. I think he's trying to set a new bar that has us with new revelations saying, well, there's nothing new in this. But it's shocking and in some ways pathetic. What it signals to me is that there's more evidence coming that makes direct ties between people extremely close to Donald Trump in his campaign, in the transition, and perhaps afterwards, that show relationships with Russia. I'll say another thing that's been so disappointing about the Republicans in Congress. We now know that Trump's interactions with Vladimir Putin were absolutely unprecedented for a president. Private meetings where he kept out his own national security team, where he had one interpreter in the room, where he did not debrief afterwards, which is the standard practice, and then demanded the notes from the interpreter, which have probably been destroyed, which is a violation of the Presidential Records Act. So we have a new sheriff in town, the Democratic House, that wants to bring in the interpreter. We had McConnell, Lindsey Graham, and even Richard Burr, who's been acting in a responsible fashion as the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, say, I don't see why we want to get those notes. And Burr saying, well, you know, he's got executive privilege. Executive privilege does not apply to a communication between an American president and a world leader.
It only applies
to a small group of White House staff. So that these people are acting as protectors of Trump in a situation where it just screams, it has neon lights flashing, danger, danger. There's only a limited number of reasons you can imagine why you wouldn't have a meeting with our greatest adversary and its dangerous leader, Vladimir Putin, and not want to have your own team of people know what was said.
And what's that reason?
That you have a relationship with Vladimir Putin where he is in league with you, either both to switch an election and to change American policies to fit Russian national interests over American national interests, or that he's got something on you and he's making you his puppet through other means. It's hard to imagine any other reality. Trump has said, hey, I have meetings with other world leaders. None of them have had an entire absence of his own team or didn't involve some interaction and briefing over what was said afterwards.
So can the note taker be subpoenaed?
The note taker, I think, can be subpoenaed, but could resist. And what we've seen is if you are subpoenaed and you don't show up, you can go to court. You can be held in contempt, and that can go and be dragged through the courts. Now, this interpreter is a career employee
of the
federal government, of the State Department. You know, it's not at all clear that the State Department could pay legal expenses under these circumstances. This is probably not somebody who's a wealthy person. It would be extremely difficult for him or her, but it's possible that we could get to the bottom of this.
Would it be up to the individual or would it be up to the Department of State?
The Department of State would refuse to let the interpreter testify. I think we have to add, this gets into territory that you would otherwise expect in a David Ignatius spy novel. This interpreter is probably fearful of his or her life.
Of course.
Probably doesn't want to talk.
And now a quick break. When we return, more of my conversation with Norman Ornstein. He is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor for The Atlantic.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Norm Ornstein, author of One Nation After Trump. Let's talk about William Barr's confirmation hearings for Attorney General. He seems to have some fairly expansive views about presidential powers. Is there anything in his testimony that troubles you?
There are a number of things that have troubled me. A number of the people that I trust and admire, Ben Wittes, for example, at the Brookings Institution, have said Barr is a good guy. He's a responsible guy. So we go into this thinking, among other things, boy, it could have been a whole lot worse. Then we had the memo that he wrote, which was a pretty vitriolic memo, that called into question not just the Russia investigation, but also suggested that there should have been more effort made on the Uranium One issue and the Clinton situation than on this. But he came into this set of hearings and did say that he would certainly let Mueller finish his work. Now, along with that, he was asked about the emoluments clauses in the Constitution. Now, these are highly visible issues now, even if they were not before Donald Trump became president. There are two of them in the Constitution, designed by the framers to guard against undue influence by foreign governments by giving things of value to top executive officials, and one on domestic affairs that said the president can't have a salary raised or lowered during the course of the term, but cannot accept anything else of value from the federal government or the states. Trump has violated both of those. It's been very prominent in the news. And when Barr, who had been attorney general, was asked about the emoluments clauses, he basically said, well, I really haven't followed. I don't know that very much. It boggles the mind, frankly, that he wouldn't have followed those things.
And what about release of the Mueller documents?
And that was the next thing that's troubling. He basically guaranteed that Mueller could finish his investigation,
right,
but he would not commit to releasing the report, and he would not commit to any action that he would take if Mueller were fired.
On what grounds?
By saying that he could be fired for cause, which is the case, but it would depend on the cause.
Yeah, what cause?
Yeah, unless Bob Mueller was stealing money or doing something absolutely horrible, there is no good cause for doing so. So we know that Barr and his family are close to Mueller and his family. It's actually entirely possible that Trump didn't know that when he picked Barr. But there are enough gaps here in terms of assurance that you have a number of people who are troubled by it. Now, you know, having said that, the Washington Post I saw did an editorial saying, confirm him quickly and, you know, we'll figure out the consequences afterward. And I think a part of that, and I can see some rationale for it, is that the acting attorney general, who I believe is in place illegally, you cannot be an acting figure if you have not, under the Vacancies Act at least, if you have not already been in a Senate-confirmed position, and that's not the case right now. But you also have somebody who had actively worked with the Trump administration to undermine the Russia investigation before this and won't recuse himself. So we have a bad situation now, and there is a reason to try and make it a little bit less bad. And Barr, I think, who is very much intertwined with the Washington community, is probably not going to want to go down in history or go back after all of this is over as somebody who undermined fundamental justice and maybe supported an administration that had been in league with Russia. So
we
can be slightly reassured, but there are some troubling elements here.
Are we in for a potential Saturday night massacre?
Yes, we are. You know, it's very clear that the noose is tightening here on Trump himself, on his family, and on others, that it's going to be very hard to say that you knew nothing about things that were going on. There are likely to be indications and evidence that Trump had very deep financial dealings with Russia going back quite some time that are going to be hard to explain away. And you can imagine Trump firing Mueller and everybody around him. What concerns me, and I mentioned this in a previous conversation with you, my worst case scenario is that he would then go on Fox and on Twitter and say, this is a coup attempt. The deep state and Hillary Clinton are trying to steal the election I won fair and square. Take to the streets. And we're going to have a lot of people who will, and there'll be confrontations and bloodshed. And then he'll say, it's out of control. I'm declaring a state of emergency. And we've had that state of emergency possibility raised in conjunction with the wall.
Indeed.
And suspending civil liberties. Now, would I say that that is a sure thing or a high probability? No. But we're in uncharted territory.
Absolutely.
Here in so many ways. And with all of that, and with our focus appropriately on the Mueller investigation, the Southern District of New York, the New York Attorney General, the New Jersey Attorney General, the lawsuit brought by the Attorneys General of the District of Columbia and Maryland over the emoluments, domestic emoluments issue, the Inspector General at the General Services Administration saying that when that agency with his employees said there's no problem with the lease on his hotel here in Washington, they violated the Constitution. With all of that, look more broadly. People in Puerto Rico still suffering. Ebola now emerging because Mulvaney, the then OMB director, now still OMB director while being chief of staff, cut the budget for the Centers for Disease Control, so they had to cut 80% of the funding for Africa to help combat pandemics, and other cuts at the CDC that'll make it tough for them if a pandemic really spreads here. Look at the damage done to all of those families seeking asylum and children who may never be reconnected with their parents or those who will be traumatized for the rest of their lives. Look at the reality that we have private prisons and other bad actors who are now in charge of holding people who are caught at the border. Look at the fact that ICE seized a person in front of a New York courthouse the other day, which means that people who are concerned about their status won't be able to go to court to protect themselves from stalkers or domestic violence or to deal with other things. The bad governance is on a par, at least, with the malfeasance or potential wrongdoing and corruption over Russia.
Norm Ornstein, thank you.
My pleasure, Diane, always.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week were Ben Privett and Natalie Urib-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.